Hi, this is Lisa from the Ohana Life Podcast. Today I interviewed Drew Hume, who is a master of many things. We talked about tissue stress, we talked about pain science, we talked about what a movement practice would look like, and we even talked about bees. So feel free to take a listen, enjoy it well. The show notes will show you where you can reach him and where you can find more information about all of his programs. It was a joy and an honor to have him on the podcast today. So enjoy. All right. Well, welcome, Drew. Thank you for wanting to do this with me today. I think that a lot of people will benefit from what the knowledge that you have to offer. I know personally that when I teach classes, I try to, you know, get people to understand their bodies a little bit better, and maybe things that they're doing throughout the day are causing some discrepancies in their body or sensations that they're not really enjoying. So I try to empower them with knowledge each and every class. And so as I get questions, I thought, these are questions for Drew. And I figured you could help answer maybe some of the things that people come in contact with what their healthcare providers may say for information, and just possibly maybe what they've read or heard. So with that, one of the things that I get most often is, you know, what about weight training? What is the best thing for, you know, the bones, the tissues, the muscles?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. First of all, thank you for having me here, Lisa. I think this is quite a big topic, especially as it relates to, like, if we get into the conversation around bone density and things like that, and its applicability to perhaps an aging population, but also not necessarily an aging population, but you know, a way to maintain good, healthy bone density scores. The first piece of that, I think, would be trying to understand the different types of muscle contractions. So in terms of the muscle contractions that we can produce, we have our isometric muscle contractions, which is when the muscle is working, but it's not changing length, at least on the level that we can see, right? On a microscopic level, there are things changing, but we won't get too much into that. Then there are our isotonic contractions, which means that we change length. So our concentric contraction is what we would normally think about when we think of a muscle contracting. And that's when the muscle contracts and it gets shorter with that contraction. You know, we often think of this kind of example where the biceps brachii are, you know, generating effort and they're shortening with that effort. But then we also have our isotonic eccentric contractions. And this one is one that we'll probably spend a little bit more time talking about, because it occurs with the muscle doing the work, lengthening at the same time. And it's a really interesting phenomenon that that the scientists that study these types of things don't even quite yet know how it works exactly. There are a few major suspects, things like the largest or the most massive protein that we have in our body, which is called titin, and its involvement. And the reason that we're going to talk about it the most is because whilst all muscle contraction is good for helping bone density, we actually get the greatest results or the most improvements from eccentric contractions. And it's because eccentric contractions of the muscle are the most efficient in terms of energy use, and they generate the most force in terms of pull on the connective tissues of the body. And when we're talking about bone density and optimizing our bone density, we want to increase the amount of pull on the tissues. And that's why recommendations for helping improve bone density involve weights, involve not, you know, sometimes it's body weight and sometimes it's external weight to add into certain movements, so that you place more strain or more stress, even physical stress, through the tissues of the body. and this works. This is a little bit of a, like, I don't know, for me, when I first read this years ago, it was a bit of a mind-blowing moment. And it was actually in Thomas Meyer's Anatomy Trains book. So if anyone has that, there's some real great pieces of information there. And it was that the pull of the connective tissues on bone is actually what helps to strengthen the bone. And it does this, it's sort of like, there's a little bit of a trail that we have to go on here to discover how this happens. You may or may not have heard of the a piezoelectric material. For those who haven't heard of what a piezoelectric material is, it is basically a substance that either changes its conformation with an induced electrical signal, or it produces an electrical signal based on a change in conformation. It's actually how things like ultrasounds work. We have crystals in ultrasounds that have been specifically grown, I guess you could say, grown in a lab to have their crystalline structure arranged in a particular way. And then when you send an electrical signal through it, it momentarily changes conformation. And what that'll do is it'll change thickness. And with that change in thickness, it sends out a vibration or a sound wave. That sound wave goes out and bounces off our internal structures, goes back to the crystal, and then the crystal is deformed by that sound coming back, and that deformation of the crystal results in an electrical impulse sent through receptors that we put into the ultrasound, and the computer reads that and we get an image. And that happens many, many, many times per minute. And we end up with an output image. So a piezoelectric material is something that deforms with a charge or generates a charge when deformed. And our connective tissues, so our fascia and the connective tissue environment that the fascia lives within, the interstitial space, is we call it a piezoelectric-like substance. It's not a perfect example of that sort of classification of piezoelectric materials. And there are people arguing out there about, you know, can we call it that or not? So I avoid that whole argument by simply saying it's piezoelectric-like, which means that it's sort of, we navigate around the conversation and we highlight the fact that when our connective tissues are deformed, they generate an electrical signal. And this is one of the forms of communication of the connective tissues that doesn't involve nerves or blood vessels. And nerves and blood vessels have their own mechanisms of communication. We live off those, we need them. And the connective tissues have their own mechanisms of communication. And this is one of them, where when deformed, there is an electrical signal that travels along the connective tissues.
When you say deformed,
yes.
Do you mean is not functioning properly?
No, I mean literally like any change in form. So like I can do that manually. I can deform my connective tissues by pulling on it, right? This is like a
pulling on his cheek. He's pulling on his cheek and his skin, okay?
Yeah, so that's one form of deformation of the connective tissue. Another would be a contraction of a muscle. With the contraction of the muscle, we're changing the way the arrangement of the connective tissues. We're inducing some kind of change. So yeah, it's either an intrinsic thing or it could also be extrinsic if you want to sit there pulling on your face the whole day. Don't necessarily recommend that. But, so when that electrical signal travels along the connective tissue network, it then gets to our bones. And we often think of our bones as being something that is sort of separate from our connective tissue, but it's not. The connective tissue is primarily comprised of collagen, right? And collagen is deeply invested in the bones. So what that means is that our bones aren't just, you know, a surface layer, and then on top of that, we start everything else, like our muscles, blood vessels, all of that. it's not a separate layer, really. There is some degree of division, but there are collagen fibers that are deeply invested in the bone. And this is part of what we call the periosteum. And the periosteum is collagen that both wraps around the bone and invests itself in the bone. And then all of the tendons, ligaments, those kinds of things that we would normally think of as being attached to bone, they're all actually attached or continuous with the periosteum and the collagen fibers that invest themselves into the bone. Okay, so when we have a muscle or connective tissue being deformed, we get a change in electrical signaling in that connective tissue network, and that travels to the bones. Okay, so we've gotten that far. The next thing we need to divert on a little bit is that there are multiple different types of bone cells. We've got osteoblasts, osteoclasts, and osteocytes. Osteoblasts, if you've ever done any sort of cell biology, anything with a blast at the end of it is like a relatively new cell that's producing a lot of stuff.
Like so a fibroblast. I know exactly. Fibroblasts. Okay.
Exactly. So fibroblasts and osteoblasts, they produce, okay? The osteoblasts are producing bone. The osteocytes and anything with a site on it is generally an older cell and one that's sort of retired from like active duty, so to speak. And so it's there and it's mostly occupying space, right? It's produced as much as it can and it's now occupying space and it stays there for a little while longer before it gets turned over. The osteoclast is the one that we are going to talk about as it relates to bone density. The osteoclast is a cell that essentially, for lack of, you know, a better explanation, it dissolves and digests bone. Now, a lot of the time we think, therefore, that the osteoclasts are bad. However, we need osteoclasts for everyday remodeling of bone. They are essential in the process of keeping our bones being produced and deposited in the right ways for the areas of bone that we're talking about. For example, the middle of the bone is a very different organization to the edge or the outside of the bone. The arrangement of cells in each of those locations is very different. So we need the osteoclasts to help digest things where things are needed to be digested, and therefore the osteoblasts can do more of their work where they're needed, okay? So they are very important cells.
Are these osteoblasts formed every day? Like there's new cells, new ones of those every single day being built, and they just need a direction of where to go?
Yes.
Because the others are dying off, okay.
Yeah, all the time we're producing more osteoblasts. Now, the production of more osteoblasts does diminish a little bit as we accrue years. However, not a ton. What changes most is osteoclast activity. And the thing that was really mind-blowing for me in Thomas Myers's book is that there is a link between this piezoelectric-like effect of the connective tissues and the activity of the osteoclasts. The osteoclasts respond to electrical signaling in the connective tissue network, which ends up being in the sort of outside layer of bone, right? By the time we transfer that electrical signal along the muscle and the connective tissues to the bone is almost like, you could almost consider it like the receptor of that electrical signal. And the osteoclasts are heavily populated in the cortical bone, which is the outside layer of bone. And they work in response to that electrical signaling. So what that means is when we are not giving or not producing very much of this electrical signaling in our connective tissues, the osteoclasts work harder. They work more. When we are producing this piezoelectric-like effect in the connective tissues. The electrical signal that arrives to the bone via the collagen network signals to the osteoclasts, and the osteoclasts lower their degree of bone digestion. This is why weight-bearing activity is helpful for the preservation of bone density, because we are essentially reducing the activity of the cells that are designed to digest bone and help reorganize it. We're reducing their activity and saying, you know what, osteoclasts, we're okay. You can still work, but you need to work a little bit less, kind of a deal. Because of course, the most advantageous adaptations that we have in our body are the ones that serve the responses of the tissues, right? So by generating force in the connective tissues, we communicate with the osteoclast to calm them down. And that occurs in proportion to the load and proportion to the electrical signaling that arrives at the bone. Okay. And so that's why oftentimes additional weight or additional load is recommended as we accrue years in our lives, so that we can keep that signaling strong to the osteoclasts to keep them working at a stable and balanced level, instead of allowing them to go into overdrive.
How do you see weight bearing as being used? I see it as maybe a one-legged deadlift or a deadlift or something like a major muscle group or a specific thing like joint work, where maybe you're only adding a pound, you know, or a block, or just that little bit extra weight, not major weight bearing on larger muscle groups that maybe aren't continued across the whole chain. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think variety, in especially when we're dealing with bone density stuff, I think variety is good. And I don't think it necessarily has to be a huge amount of load. And it should be progressively added, right? Because when we get to a certain adaptation, it's nice to keep an adaptation curve going. So we would need to add more load in that instance. However, for a lot of people, starting light is wonderful. And there are many different ways that we can position our bodies to load more without picking up more external weight, right?
Exactly. So these would be ways to get the electrical signaling in the tissues. So do you want to tell us what those ways might be?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that some of the main areas where people would be experiencing lower bone density are in the arms, in the upper arm bones especially, and in the hips. For the hips, you know, we've got a huge range of different things we might be able to do for the hips. But a lot of like one-legged standing work, I think, is really powerful for that. And we have to remember, especially for something like the hip, we have to remember all of the different directions in which the hip can move. Because if we are looking to more holistically maintain our bone density, or at least slow the loss of bone density, which is where a lot of people find themselves after getting tested, is if we only move in certain ways, we're only going to strengthen the bone in those certain areas that those attachments of muscle are found. And so, you know, I would encourage people to do balance work, yes, but also then balance work with, you know, the other leg all in all directions, almost like a trying to find a clock mechanism, right? And loading up the tissues around the pelvis in a variety of different ways. For the shoulders and for the upper arm bones, I think in general, I really think that our upper limb is quite often neglected in all of the ways that it can and should operate. For a lot of people, overhead range is missing. So I would even, for a lot of people, just focus on developing overhead range. And that often will place you into positions and require efforts that are going to be beneficial for bone density. Things like doing a dolphin pose, right? Forearms down, walking the feet in, sticking the bum up. And then instead of just holding it there, sometimes that might be enough, but instead of just that, why not try like bringing your nose forward to see if you can touch the ground? Like the amount of load that drives, or the amount of force that drives through the connective tissues, is substantial. Even though it's a relatively small movement, it's more about how you position your body weight and leverage your body weight to generate that force instead of necessarily adding more external things.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah, I mean, we're not used to having hands on the ground and doing things weight bearing on the arms during the day. I mean, we're sitting, we're driving, we maybe are picking up groceries, but this overhead range, this pushing and the pulling, just isn't a range that we normally get to.
Yeah, exactly. The pulling, especially, you know, I often recommend for my people, for my clients, for manual therapy and things like that, to start working on hanging. Hanging work is something that so many of us really need, myself included. You know, I have rings over on the training platform over there, and even just a static hang is really challenging. And that's just because I haven't done it for years and years and years and years. Not because it is something that we shouldn't be able to do. It's just because I haven't done it for years. And so I need to add, you know, more time under tension in those areas to develop more strength, to pull on those bones more.
So let's talk about two things, actually. Time under tension, but before that, what about the people who hang and their back hurts? You know, I've recommended maybe just like take one foot off the floor and just have that. Yeah. What do you think, or why do you think the back is hurting while they're hanging?
If that could be any number of reasons. I think depending on the regions and the types of sensations that they're experiencing, sometimes, even when it's been a long time since I've done some hanging work, I find that the decompression sensation can sometimes be so significant that it almost feels painful. So it could be that, but then it also could be, you know, we are requiring a lot of range of things like our latissimus dorsi in that scenario. And so the pull of the latissimus dorsi, you know, travels down into the lumbar region. And so it could be heavily participating in increases in sensation. So I do think like you suggested, one foot off the floor at a time, gradually adding a little bit more body weight each time you hang. And, you know, you could also get a little bit fancy at a point where you're in between, you know, one foot and no feet on the floor. If you have some kind of elastic system, you could use the elastic system around your feet or around your knees to give you just a little bit of lift and support. So you're filling in that space between one foot and no feet on the ground. So that kind of work is good. And then also, you know, staying there for a while. So that bridges into this idea of time under tension. Especially if we're thinking of the discussion around bone density, time under tension is really important. The longer we do certain things, so the more repetitions we do certain things for, and the more frequently we do them, the more rapid these adaptations will be. So the faster we will slow the loss of bone density.
So the longer you hold something time under tension, the more electrical signaling you get in the tissues.
Yes.
Which in turn helps everything, including the bones.
Mm. Yes, exactly. You know, we've hopefully all felt what it feels like to hold something like that for a long period of time, and the shaking and things like that. What's happening there is, there are many things happening there, but one of the things that's happening is the fatigue of certain muscle fibers is then requesting the input from other muscle fibers that aren't necessarily always participating. And so we end up generating more continuously, we end up generating those electrical signals in the connective tissues.
And would you say that that's, so fibroblasts are kind of headed in that area when the shaking happens. Would you say like blood flow is happening to that area as well? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially to the muscles. In that particular instance, you're getting a lot of blood flow because at least, you know, if we are working in an aerobic range, at least we're getting a lot of extra blood flow because our muscles need the energy and we need to exchange oxygen there. For anaerobic activity, so for the really high intensity stuff, we are not necessarily getting a huge amount of increase in blood flow until after, but definitely for the endurance type stuff, the longer we hold things for, yeah, increase in blood flow is
so at least what, 2.5 minutes, or for someone that maybe is stronger in this area or the tissues are better formed, they just go until they're shaking. Until they feel that kind of deep inner shake. Yeah. Okay.
Fatiguing is great. And if that happens before the couple of minutes, you know what, so be it. It's a good signal that we can work towards a couple of minutes under that type of tension.
Yeah. I know for me, I've had a lot of car accidents and head injuries. And I know that the neck area just tends to be, you know, the structure to me always seems to get that shaking quicker. So I'll do something like laying on my back and just pushing my head back towards the floor and my shoulder blades. And as soon as I have those two kind of unite in that isometric contraction, the shaking happens immediately kind of in the structural muscles of the neck.
You know, I think in your case as well, any type of motor vehicle accident will confound stuff going on here. And I think already in our culture, this area is one where we tend to benefit from a lot of extra work anyway, because of the nature of our lifestyles and what have you. And then you've also got on top of that, the history of the MVA, right? Which certainly doesn't assist.
Now, Drew, how do you keep up on your education? So are you reading, you know, research articles constantly, or are you taking, you know, your kind of mentors and kind of studying under them? I'm just curious.
At the moment, in the last 6 or 7 years, it's mostly self-directed learning. Since leaving university, which actually was longer than that ago now, university, there was obviously, I have wonderful teachers and they really gave me a lot of resources and things to think about. And since then, I've really sort of taken things on in a bit more of a self-directed fashion. And when questions come up like this kind of a thing, there's some data in here already, and then oftentimes I will take a little bit of time to search Google Scholar and come up with research articles with a little bit more recent information than perhaps my degree. And so if there have been changes in information since my degree, I get a little update in that at that point. Or if there's something that, you know, is an overhaul of knowledge, then it's always good to catch up on that kind of a thing, right? So I honestly think I read more of the scientific journal type thing than I do books and what have you, but one day I'll get into some more books. I do enjoy books. It's just at this stage, I'm certainly researching articles a little bit more frequently.
Yeah, I'm finding I'm somehow getting sucked into these research articles as well. And I feel like you probably understand them a little bit better than I do. But at least for me, it's this introduction to, you know, what is out there for science and what are they studying? What is your degree in?
It's a Bachelor of Applied Science in Human Biology. Yeah.
So there's, and there won't be enough time for this topic in this little podcast that we're doing. Pain science, let's go with that. So, you know, I've done trainings with you in conditions. I've done training with you level one anatomy with shoulder anatomy and extra trainings that we've done. Pain you know, pain is not what we think it is. And everyone, you know, feels it differently, these sensations of what we think is pain. Do you want to give us just maybe a little synopsis of what is going on currently for research with pain?
Yeah, I think there are some really exciting things happening, actually, especially if you follow people like, Lorimer Moseley. Yeah, he is exploring things really profoundly and getting some really amazing results as it relates to pain being part of the biopsychosocial model of health, right? Where our experience of sensation is not just the information that's coming in from the immediate moment, nor is it necessarily coming in the appropriate proportions to what is happening. And, you know, it feeds in a whole history of life experiences that could be related, and the complexities of our brain, it starts to bridge past experiences with, you know, how we like to think about our self-preservation. And it's taking what we think we know about pain and just flipping it upside down, because a lot of people think pain equals bad and the degree of pain equals the degree of bad. And whilst there are certainly some circumstances where that's true, there's also a lot of circumstances where it's not true. And, you know, even at home thinking, you might be able to think of certain instances where you were like, oh, that should have really hurt more than it did. Like, I remember when I was, 12 or so, I was walking through a garden because I was chasing a bird because I wanted to see it because I'm just weird. And I tripped and I fell and I got up. And Dad said, he's like, oh, you okay? You okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. And then he looked at my ankle and it was like, there was a hole in my ankle. Like I'd actually tripped over wire and cut my ankle. And it was like, it was maybe this long. And it was like a white, you could see my connective tissue, like the tendons in my ankle. And I was like, oh, I'm fine. And then he's like, and I was like, ooh, okay, ouch. Anyway, that was when we lived in the middle of nowhere and we had to drive 45 minutes to get to a hospital. But anyway, that's another story for another day. But there are situations like that where, I mean, I think a lot of people at home could probably think of certain situations where it's like, huh, I feel like that should have hurt more than it did, but it didn't. And that's just one example of how complex it is. In that scenario, it was not helpful for me to feel the amount of pain that, you know, you would normally think of experiencing when your ankle is cut open and you can see white tissue underneath. It wouldn't have been helpful in that situation, right? It would have served no purpose. It wouldn't have got me anywhere quicker, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, dealing with people's pain is it has to be dealt with in this biopsychosocial realm where we have to look at all the pieces and all the history. And I like that doctors are starting to go there with it. I mean, it's like a paper cut, right? A paper cut shouldn't hurt as much as it does, but it does.
It does. It's immense amount of pain sometimes. It's just part of that complexity of pain. An experience of a sensation as well. A lot of the times in my conversations now, I try to direct the conversation in towards sensation, because I think sensation is a little bit more informative than pain, especially if we can ask people, you know, if we're working with people who are experiencing pain, and not to say that they're not experiencing pain, but the word pain doesn't help us understand it. So I try to get them to, you know, tell me more about the sensation. Is it sharp, dull, tingly, numb, you know, what are the characteristics of that sensation that you call pain?
Because that can tell, that's very telling.
Yeah, that helps us to understand what's going on more of a physiological level, whether it's, you know, hot or not, might be the difference between an inflammatory pain and something else entirely. And So getting more data from people is, I think, really helpful to understand what, in that particular instance, pain means for them. And, you know, I think it fits nicely into the whole idea of treating the individual and meeting the individual, and letting them be the guide of how the steps unfold, basically, yes. as opposed to trying to assert what we think we know about their pain condition, and exploring it with them and being a guide and being receptive to what they're experiencing.
Mm. Drew, what do you think is the best movement for people? I mean, in my head, I always categorize like upper body, lower body, or arms, legs, head, hips, you know, how do you categorize your movement?
I would say historically, up until quite recently, I would have said, more important is to, for most people in this culture, is to work on upper body stuff. More and more lately, my own movement practice is very different. Like just before this call, I was way up the mountain and carrying a huge box, a huge B box, an empty one, mind you, but a huge B box on my shoulder, my head, my back, you know, under my arm, all that kind of stuff. And so I'm finding that in my own body, and this it feeds in so well with all of the things that I've theoretically understood as it relates to moving well, is I would say movement complexity of the whole organism. So, and I first noticed this in my own body, at least a couple of months ago, when I started to bring up, there are some huge chunks of wood that someone cut up and left down in next to the waterfall. And I was putting...
Just so people know, Drew is in Costa Rica. And when he says bees, he really was carrying like a bee, not a bee box, like a music thing. This is actually a box that was holding bees because he is also a bee connoisseur. And that's a whole nother podcast.
Yes, that's a whole nother one. But carrying these huge things of wood up that are ridiculously heavy, and I did incremental load, so I didn't go too crazy to begin with. But after that complex series of requirements, and I'm walking up a slope that's like this with a load, you know, unbalanced, and I'm switching sides and doing that, I found every time I did it, I got back up here and I dropped the wood and everything felt like it was working. Everything felt like it was, you know, there was something requested of it. My legs, all of the joints in my lower limb, my hips, my pelvis, my butt, my back, it felt like all of the muscles of my back and my subsystems of core were required to keep me walking on a slope like that. My upper limb, of course, was holding and balancing, and it felt like a complete experience for my tissues. And so I would say something like lifting something reasonably heavy, not too heavy for you, but lifting reasonably heavy and walking on uneven surfaces would be my current best recommendation for best movement, period.
I know, you know, it brings you back to people love, you know, we're here in New Hampshire, people love walking, they love running, they love cycling, they love these activities. And I love that they love those things for hobbies. But yes, you know, kind of sprinkling in there these ideas of moving just in different ways, varied ways, and having these unbalanced loads everywhere on all the joints. Because good joint health, right, it makes for good tissues and good bones. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so I feel go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, you know, that we can't emphasize variety enough. You know, I even think that as much as we explore relatively in our movement practices nowadays, I think especially, you know, as you're teaching, Lisa, some of the detour type stuff, it takes us on a journey of exploring movement in different ways. And it's still the box is bigger, but it's still a little bit boxed, right? When you take in an uneven surface, it adds a whole new dimension to it, which I think is really cool. You know, there is a huge amount that we can do and that people need within that box of what you could classify as yoga, right? And I think that that is hugely powerful, and there's so much good that we can do in that space and so much variety that we can employ and explore and play with. And outside of that, there's even a little bit more freedom, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, I've been teaching in town, just in town here for 11 years, and I've never had the same class twice. I mean, people know that only because, you know, you're learning new things and there's different people in your class all the time, and they all need sometimes they need different work in different areas. And as the years progress, you know, the needs are different, you know, hips tend to be around here more of an issue, to work on, than before. So
I think that's a really responsive model of coaching movement. When you can observe people, and when you can, you know, request a movement and see how it's executed, and then, you know, receive that data and think, ooh, that's not that's something else entirely. You know, it gives you something else to play and focus on. And I think the responsive model of that is just so critical to coaching people and helping people feel better. This is the part where a lot of movement educators really, I hope, are trying to direct their attention, is to helping people move and feel better. And it's an area that's still evolving, but it's so important to be responsive in your work.
Yeah, and I feel like the more I learn, the less I know. Or when I do take a program like your trainings, you know, I get confirmed, you know, knowledge about certain things, and just understand that everyone is different. It depends. And that assessment is necessary always. How do our words fall on people? How do they respond? And then take action from there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way to do it.
So why don't you tell us what you are up to, Drew? You have so many things going on, including the bees, which I can't wait to talk to you about some other time. But you know, you have a lot of programs in the works, anatomy, movement classes online. I don't know what's going on with your Thai yoga massage, but tell us what's going on with you, Drew.
There is so much. So we've now got the online studio on the roll, which is fantastic. We create, we curate weekly movement menus, basically. So it's almost like a little bit more of a similar experience to an in-person class, where you never know what you're going to get necessarily. And so that's up and running, and that's been a really great piece to have on the go. And I'm actually working on some collaborations to feed into that space as well, which is exciting. Then we've got the anatomy and physiology intro course. We've got the next round of that coming up, actually releasing at the end of the month. Doors will be opening for registration on the 27th, it is, I believe. And that really kicks people off. It gives people a solid foundation upon which we would then delve deeper into anatomy and physiology study. And we've also got the next level is available as well. It's the anatomy and physiology of the shoulder girdle. It's a pretty dense, and you can speak to that, Lisa, but it's a pretty dense shoulder girdle experience where we get into things like movement assessment. What are we looking for when something looks a certain way? What could be going on? And if that's the case, you know, what are our possible interventions? Manual therapy, movement isolation, movement integration, those kinds of things, so that we can take the care to the next level, start assessing people and feeding that into a broader understanding of how we can help those people move and feel better. Then we've also got, you know, the Thai massage courses, the Thai massage trainings, of course, given the current global environment, they are largely on pause. There is something that we are doing right now, though. One of my team members is taking people through modules 1, 2, and 3 online. We've received some really wonderful, wonderful feedback. It went from, you know, trying it out with one person to now she's working with her fourth person, training them through our modules 1, 2, and 3 online. So that's been really great to have that roll out and for it to have been received so well, because touch, you know, it's a very complex environment. And the classroom environment is a little bit better equipped for having those conversations, for exploring the intricacies of touch. I wasn't sold on the idea of it being in an online format, but I think it's a one-on-one basis. And I think in a one-on-one basis online, it's working quite well. And then of course we have the bees.
But you also have a retreat center.
Oh yeah, the retreat center. Yeah. So that's where I am. That's where I live now. So we've got the retreat center. At the moment, there are, of course, no retreats happening. So we're planning for a full season next season with luck. Fingers crossed, dedos cruzados. That's been wonderful too. We've now had our second season. Next season will be our third. It's just been wonderful to have people come in from all over and get to experience this place. We're really right in the middle of the rainforest. I'm not sure, but earlier and now a little bit, the howler monkeys are going. I'm not sure if you could hear them, but
I can. I love it. It reminds me of when I was in India. You always heard sounds and monkeys and birds. It's the best.
There you go. Yeah, it's really raw nature, and I think that a lot of people need that. And for everyone who's come here, there has been a moment of like, wow, I didn't realize how much I needed this, you know, and even if bugs are an issue, so many people have been transformed with their, degree of tolerance or enjoyment of bugs.
The insect species, yes.
And I always say to people when they arrive, I always say, you know, if you don't like bugs, just keep in mind that you will miss them when you're gone from here. And everyone laughs at me. And I tell you, a good 80% of those people who laughed have messaged me and said, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I actually miss the bugs. You know, the noises that they make, the white noise that is made in the background is incredible. Sometimes it's really loud. But then when you go back to a city, there's no sound. And it's quite a strange reverse culture shock kind of a situation. There they are.
It is nice to have, I mean, they're kind of in their own natural state of just doing their own thing and, you know, providing for each other. And I think that we need to kind of get back into that space of just doing our little jobs and contributing as a collective.
I think the bees exemplify that, right? Like we have now, I think we've got 16 colonies of stingless bees, different species of stingless bees here at the center. And we are just sort of stepping into honeybee work, not necessarily having the honeybees on site, because obviously that would generate some greater risk for people who are allergic, but we are working with people up the mountain to have some space up there. You know, I think the bees really exemplify what it means to live and work and contribute in community. And I'm just amazed on a daily basis, the amount of work they do, the ways in which they collaborate. And you know, a lot of people think it's the queen that runs the show. And whilst she decides where they live and she lays the eggs and what have you, It's not a hierarchical system at all. She doesn't give out orders. That would be a very inefficient way of managing about 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 other individuals in the colony. Everyone figures it out. They collaborate and they work together. And that just blows my mind. It's a very
No one bee says, oh, I just did so much work today. You know, I need to rest. It's no, they all just are like, no, we're working together. This is just what we do.
Exactly. I read this fact the other day of in an average lifespan of a bee, which is about 5 to 6 weeks, on average, The distance that they fly is 2 to 3 times around the circumference of the Earth.
Wow, holy cow.
That is some distance.
That is some distance. Wow.
Yeah.
So with that, that's amazing. You always have these good tidbits. I love when you do that. I follow Drew on social media, of course, and through all the training programs that I do. So he's on Instagram, Facebook, all that. So I'll link that all in to quote unquote show notes. This is my first one. And you always have great articles, Drew. You always have really nice, just they're short, easy to read, easy to understand articles on just different topics, which I think are all super fascinating for where I am at right now. I love them. So hopefully people can get some use out of those.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me, Lisa. I'm really glad
Thank you.
I didn't have this chat.